Welcome to Sonship Podcast with me, your host, John McDonald, and my guests today are voices that may be familiar to you from previous podcasts. I have my friend Florian Berndt from Germany, and
hey, John.
A dear friend, Alicia Murrell from the US. I won't go into a big biography of these guys, but these are special people with voices that I think you need to hear. Anyway, Felicia, welcome. Florian, welcome.
Glad to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure. Yeah.
Good to be here again.
So one of the things I wanted to talk about, and I thought you guys were the perfect people to talk about it, was a quote I read from Brad Jerzak on Facebook. I'll read the quote and then we can go wherever the conversation takes us. And he wrote this. He said, "The Great Father's Heart Revelation continues to face resistance from many of its own esteemed teachers, where it has not yet penetrated their commitment to transactional retribution in their constructs of God, expressed in dogmatic systems of original sin, penal substitution, and eternal conscious torment. So long as these errors persist, they will continue to hinder complete trust in and intimacy with the Father. The broken parts of us that most need Abba's love cannot surrender to the loving kindness of perfect love if they are taught to believe the same divine being can only be satisfied through violent wrath or eternal torment." It's a bit of a mouthful. It covers a lot of ground there. I don't know if we'll be able to cover it all, but I just thought, when I read it, I thought, yeah, that's been my discovery, that the deeper I've gone into this love, there's actually a clash between traditional dogmatic systems that he talks about there. I don't know about you guys, what your experience is in that.
I'll just echo and say I agree. I think that I've definitely seen that clash in my own journey. But I also think it really, for me, took an invitation by Spirit to invite me to let go of some of the ways that I had been thinking about God, about eternal conscious torment, about a lot of things, really, that I just accepted as, this is what I was taught, or this is what the Bible says, you know, from a literal kind of interpretation of it, was never really taking the journey with Spirit to see if there actually could be something else that love was inviting me to see besides what I had always seen before.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with what Brad wrote in the same way. Actually, this has been true in my own experience, and very often I have experienced it with other people. At some point, whenever we did a Father Heart event, where a retreat or something, people would call me afterwards or come to me in the break times, and like Nicodemus at night, and say, "What do you think about that? You know, and what about that?" And I just saw that, or, you know, and I always had to say, well, that's what I'm thinking. It's not the official position of the ministry we're working with, but, and not that there weren't people who didn't see it like me, but I just had to say, that's how I see it and what I found out, and encouraging them to study it out for themselves, and which I always think is the best way to do. But I think there is something that we will not be able to completely open up our hearts and trust him as long as you think God has this dark side that needs to be appeased, and that actually in our essence, we are not made in his image. We are not good. You know, we're not coming from a good father, a good mother, good parent. And,
I think that's important, though, you say that, Florian, about made in his image, because the original image may have been obscured, but it's never been removed. You know, we may have lost sight of our true image, but that true image still exists, and it's what God sees when he looks at humanity. You know, but somehow we've covered it up with blood and guts and evil and blackness and, if you want to go the whole hog, it's like total corruption, total depravity, you know, almost that we're as bad as we could ever be. And yet, you look at the on the other side of the mirror, that's not what God's looking at all.
And if you think about it, if you've been abused as a child, or you've grown up in a home where what you've been told you were bad, you buy into that. You know, even if you were not treated necessarily violently, something, but somehow you believe this lie, you're inherently bad. And the gospel message starts with you're inherently bad. Then you believe all this stuff. Then you believe it's, I deserve it. I remember, how do I tell that? I remember when I was young, someone punching me in the face and thinking, because I had already gone through the religious indoctrination, yeah, I deserve that because I'm bad. Yeah. And only when I experienced the Father's love was it broken off me, or started breaking off me. And that's why penal substitution was the first thing, for example, the idea that God punishes his son instead of us, and that's what we would have deserved. That was the first thing that went. Like, after I experienced the Father's embrace in an experience, I could no longer believe that. Didn't make any sense. And no one was talking back then yet about the theology behind it. But I started to see it. And then I was so glad finding people like Brad who actually were talking about it. Yeah.
I'm with Florian. At the example that immediately came to mind, I was thinking of, parenting. I've seen my own mom, grandmother's aunt, display what they would call tough love, with their kids, where, and so for them, that punishment was to teach you a lesson. It was to try to make you into a better person, really to kind of corral you or control you, right? And so whether that meant putting you outside the house, or, not helping you with something, or an actual, spanking back in our day. But there was the intent was to bring you back into line. And so I think because we grew up with this idea that, it's okay for love to hurt. It's okay. Punishment is justified if there's good intent on the other side of it. And I think because we've had these kind of skewed ideas about it, whether they are conscious or not, they tend to be how we govern ourselves and how we govern relationships, that it's easy to accept this God who would condone putting people into hell, because that's just, trying to bring them back into line so that when you get to the part of judgment, they've learned this lesson now, or whatever like that. And we don't really stop, I think, to think about how we put our images and our behaviors onto God, instead of really, like, as you were saying, John, that, and Florian, being made in his image, right? Mm. That's not remaking God in our image, but a lot of times we do subvert that instead of looking at the Imago Dei and looking at the sacred, And so we tend to go first to the other side of it, the monstrous side versus the sacred or the holy side.
And it's interesting, when we look at the cross, that we talk about God's wrath is poured out upon Christ in our stead, when actually it's Jewish wrath and Roman wrath that's been poured out upon this man on the cross. And in the face of it, he says, forgive them. I don't think Jesus has prayed a prayer that Father hasn't answered. So, but that when I actually saw that picture, and read Isaiah 53, and it said, we considered him stricken by God. In other words, we imagined that our wrath was God's wrath, our violence was God's violence. And it's like you say, Felicia, we're just painting him in our image to justify our violence, our desire for revenge, if you like, even in retribution. If we say, well, I'm doing this in God's name.
No, the horrible thing about with everlasting conscious torment is even there's not even a purpose behind it, except just getting even. with someone, you know.
Well, it's not
even a good end to get to.
It's not getting even, though, is it? Because it's just malicious.
It's not
spiteful torture. Because you wouldn't let me control you. If you want to put it in human terms, you won't let me control you. Well, I'll make you pay for that. It's just another picture of spiteful humanity.
But at the same time, we talk about free will and having a choice, and that love requires a choice. So if love requires a choice, and with my choice, I decide not to choose you, but then you get to come and punish me because you told me I had a choice and I didn't choose what you wanted. I mean, none of that really, like when we really lay it out, it does not make any sense at all.
No,
I Paul Young once said that heaven and hell were proximity to love. You know, heaven would be like the closer I am to love, and then hell would be the torment of being further away from love. And that to this day has stuck with me so much because when I am alienated, because of course we know that love never leaves us and never abandons us and never gives up on us. But there are times when we walk in a kind of bleakness that feels alienated and isolated from love. And in the isolation, alienation that we tend to create for ourselves, it is hell. I mean, that torment feels like hell. It's, our minds are spinning, you know, with that. But when we are in the lavish affection of love, and we all have come through this revelation of love to know what it feels like for that embrace, for it to wash over you and to change you from the inside out. And, you know, once you have that experience, it is heaven. It is the seal that's set on your heart that will never change. And to think that a love like that would only be for certain elect people, that only those people, you know, who have chosen this will get to experience this and everyone else will get torment for eternity. It just makes no sense.
No, it doesn't. But so many of us grew up with that. You know, I think the problem is, you know, we've talked about being indoctrinated, but I think we've actually been traumatized. You know, I grew up in the Roman Catholic Church here in Scotland, and we are a peculiar culture here. Very tribal along religious lines, Protestant Catholic, you know, John Knox and all that, and Queen Mary. And so I grew up, you know, not literally, but it was almost like Protestants eat the babies, you know, don't go near the Protestants, they'll eat your babies. but hell was a massive thing. And I never realized I'd been traumatized until recently, actually. Because I used to wake up in the middle of the night terrified that I was not good enough to go to hell. I was 11 years old. 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old. 12 years old, I walked away from church. And I never realized that actually I was dealing with trauma. And I never knew it. How many people have we got in Christianity or just in society who are walking with trauma, religious-induced trauma in their lives? No wonder they don't want to connect with love when we talk about Jesus and God, because they don't see that as love. They see torture, torment, hell, and it's just re-traumatizing them.
If you think about it, it's a narrative of the survival of the fittest.
Yeah. But it's just, for those of us who have come through this Father's Heart revelation, who have discovered love like we never thought was possible or imagined was even real, to continue to hold on to these dogmatic systems, like Brad says, original sin, penal substitution, eternal conscious torment, it creates a dissonance. You know, you've got to be cognitively dissonant to try and to hold on to both beliefs. One has to go. You know, God cannot be love and. He is either love or he's the and. He can't be both. But yeah, I think it's when like, we continue to hold on to things like hell and everything else, then I think we're just re-traumatizing people.
And I think that the scriptures themselves, they struggle with this issue of our perception of God and how he really is, and how Jesus showed him. When you look at Jesus and you look at his life, the gospel accounts, and you look at the God he reveals, there is no wrath in that God. You know, no. He's a life giver. He's Abba. And but then we try to, you see it even in the early church, how people try to put it back in this religious package again, you know, and some people get it, some don't, you know. And I think that's what also happened in church history. You know, we try to drag it back into this old system to make people comply again to this control, and basically using the original serpent lie to get it all back. You go back, but you can climb this ladder, or if you do this, then you can prove yourself. And it also, a lot of what we teach or taught in this revelation, like we would say, Father knows us inwardly, you know, intimately from before he formed in the mother's womb. He knew what we would think. He knew what we would feel. And then we say, yeah, but then he doesn't know how to convey his love to us. He doesn't know how to draw us to himself. And we say things like, he put the couple out of the garden because he didn't want them to live forever in a state of corruption. And then we go back and say, yeah, well, in the ultimate end, some people he's going to put into a state of everlasting corruption, you know, because if you believe in everlasting conscious torment, then people are going to exist forever in that state. And it's these kind of things that just don't measure up when we really take this revelation seriously. And I think Michael Harden calls it the Janus-faced God, you know, who is love, but he's also wrath.
Oh, Janus, yeah.
He's mercy and justice, you know. And there have even been Christian books where portrayed God with the two faces, and he's got his two sides. And how do they say it? Hold the attributes in tension. And I like what Michael Harden said. Well, if God is tense, he needs to see a therapist. it's true, you know. I mean, some people might find it offensive, but it's true. It's not the Abba of Jesus.
Yeah, yeah, I think the idea that God is who is love, so love is not free to forgive without requiring retribution. Once I scourge you, then I'm free to forgive you. Seriously? But you haven't forgiven me because you've scourged me. That's not forgiveness. You know, if you owe me money and I beat you up and then say, okay, I'll let you off with the debt, I haven't really forgiven you because I've just beaten you up. And instead of taking cash from you, I've taken blood from you. That's not forgiveness. That's not love.
And it's not. And
it's just another form of retribution. Yeah.
Pardon?
I said it's just another form of retribution.
Yes. Uh-huh. Exactly.
And if somebody else has to pay for it, it's neither justice.
No. Yeah. Hey, yeah, it's like me saying, Flora and Felicia owes me $100. I want you to pay it to me. And you're like, but I don't owe you $100. Felicia owes you. I said, I don't care. I don't care who I get $100 from. I just want $100. And I want it from anyone that's got it, so give it to me now. And it's almost like we're saying God does that. You know, these people offended me. I don't care who gets it. Someone has to pay for it. And it turns out to be Jesus. Jesus pays for it, you know. And it's just crazy.
That also, John, I think goes back to the images that we put on God to try to explain God, to try to know God. Because, you know, when you talk about, you know, Jesus paying the debt and just wanting that $100, then we're making God out to be judge You know, some people make God out to be a judge. Some people make God out to be a physician. Whatever image we think to, he's the shepherd. But we create these images inside of our language, the finiteness of our language, to try to know a divine that is unknowable. You know, but part of our humanity is that we need to resolve things and be certain about it, instead of really, you know, taking spirit's invitation into mystery, because part of it is, it's just a mystery. But we'd rather actually feel like we know that there's a heaven, we know that there's a hell, we know what that looks like. But the reality is, none of us have died and come back and can say for sure what those things look like. You know, it's just that when we look at Jesus, right, like Florian was saying, you do not see, you know, love being portrayed in wrath. You do not see love. The only thing that I can see, I will say, is I see the fire of love being aimed at all that opposes love's time, so that all of the things within us that are keeping us from the truth of our being and from the expression of love that we were born to be in the world is to be burned up. But that is not hell. That is, you know, like a refiner's fire, like purifying gold, right? And so that's quite different. But
That's good. Yeah.
What really annoyed me about it is about the everlasting conscious torment thing is that a lot of the people that we would quote and a lot of the heroes of the faith later in life would have a more inclusive view. Like, if you think about Andrew Murray in his book, The Secret to Prayer, he has a whole chapter about it that was taken out. You think about people like Hannah Whiffle Smith, who wrote her autobiography, The Unselfishness of God, 3 chapters in it, how she had a bigger revelation of this inclusiveness of God's love. They took it out, didn't even mention it was in there, and because it didn't fit the system. And you look at people like Andrew Jukes and all these guys who pioneered the whole reading the Bible allegorically in the 19th century and stuff like that, in the Brethren movement. And you have all these people that we would quote, you know, these heroes of the faith, and we never actually mention what they really believed. And especially as they got older and grew in love, they had a more inclusive view. And when we look at the early church, it was the same. There was a lot of diversity even before they put together the canon and all this kind of stuff. And they could all get on with each other because what held them together was the love. And it was more about learning to love like Jesus, learning to live like Jesus, becoming like Jesus. It was not about getting your doctrine right. There was such a diversity of views in the early church that people wouldn't recognize it anymore in the Western world, what the church looked like. And it really started to frustrate me after a while to see how certain things have just been suppressed. You know, people don't even know about some of the things, or how certain Bible words have been mistranslated. Like when we take judgment, it's not seen as something that's, we think of a courtroom. I mean, we talked about it yesterday, John, you know, rather than actually a parent putting things right. And we even corrupted what justice means. You know, we have all these words that we think we know what they mean, but we filter them through a certain narrative. And
justice we see as the courtroom. Yeah. You know, the criminal, the crime, the sentencing, the punishment, and we think that's justice. Yeah.
But when you really look at it, like, justice is right alignment, right? I mean, I can think, you know, I'm an editor, so I think justice and I immediately go to margins on the page, right? And so I think right alignment, right? And so again, it's, you know, some of the pictures matching too. If you have one picture of this and I have a different picture of this, we're missing each other inside of that. But I do think I have this really uncanny experience that I actually will never forget. And I was watching a video of a preacher that I used to follow quite a bit, and I really loved their teaching. And I remember watching this video, and he was just going for it and going for it. And I heard so clearly, like, inside of myself, spirit say, do you believe that? Right. And I heard it and I just kept watching this video. And then a few minutes later, I heard that invitation again. Do you believe that? And I thought, huh? And I went like, well, do you believe that? Like, should I not be believing this? Are you trying to tell me what in the world is going on? And spirit said back to me, I believe that that's true to him where he is right now in his journey. Mm. Right. Wow. And so I think for a lot of us, there was a time in our journey where eternal conscious torment was true. Hell was true. Right. But I think as we are open to spirit and we start knowing this love, part of the reason why we have this revelation of love is for love to reveal love self to us, to show us what we didn't know, right? To invite us into a freedom that's beyond the borders of knowledge, that's beyond the borders of, you know, certainty. And so when that happens, then all of a sudden love starts going, okay, you once believed this, you once believed this, you know, and here's a different way. Here's what I believe. Here's the heart of the matter. What matters to Father, what matters to love is people. So where is love radiating through people here? Because if people are being maligned or hurt, or like you said, John, traumatized inside of these beliefs, that is not love. That is not the kindness of God. And if it does not stand up to love and the kindness of God and charity and mercy and grace, it's time to say, maybe that's something I believe right now in my journey, but in the face of love, in the face of divine love, that cannot be true. It cannot be true.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in a place just now where I kind of like, I think I know some things about God that are true. I think I know some things about God that aren't true. And there's a whole big gap of nothingness where I don't know anything. I think, you know, I have a relationship of some kind with him, but I don't know God. You know, I think that's a misleading statement to say I know God. I think I have some sort of relationship with him, but I don't know him. To know him means to experience all he is, to understand what he is, and I don't. And I keep coming back to the verses that get misquoted in Isaiah. You know, my ways are higher than your ways. And he's talking about it in the context of grace and kindness towards offenders. They're saying, you know, like, smite them, crush them, and he's saying, hey, guys, my ways are higher than your ways. And it's like, wow, that is mind-blowing. You know, that is... So I can only say, well, I don't understand his ways, but I'm getting to know some of them. And through that, understand a little bit of who he is. But I still wouldn't say that I know him.
It one day hit me that the Bible is not so much about us getting to know God, but him knowing us, that we are fully known, and he sees us and understands us. And I was talking to a friend, and he said that's the thing, that when he believes, he's older, and he thinks when he crosses over, and that he said one of the first things I will experience is that I'm fully understood. You know, everything I went through in life, I'm fully understood. And he said it with tears in his eyes. And
I love that.
And it just stuck with me. It's not about what we know. It's about us trusting, learning to trust and lean into that we are known and fully understood.
Oh. Yeah.
Still can't wrap my head around that, but trying to.
I think for me too, inside of that, Florian, like I don't even want to get trapped in the hierarchy of humanity as supreme, right? Because so many times, even when we talk about Jesus being incarnate, we can demean the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom,
yes,
you know, matter, and that like humans have consciousness and we're the only one and all of this kind of stuff. And I, what I want is to
preach it. There are dogs in heaven.
what I want is for us to see, I think there's an invitation, right, from the divine to see the radiance of all, of all, of the trees, of the dogs, of, you know, the plants, of the birds, of humanity even, but not just humanity, right? And so, and for us to come into that, there's something that's beautiful about holding the sacredness of matter, that matter matters, right? Mm-hmm. All matter. All matter matters. And but holding the sacredness of it. And when you begin to really see the radiance and the glory of the divine, of divine love reflected, not just in humans, but in everything around you, when you can stop and see the awe and the wonder of this gift of being here and this world around us and the cosmos and all of that, I don't know how inside of that pause, of that stillness of awe, that you can say the person that created this would damn it all to hell. I don't know how you hold those two things together. It just, you know, but you have to have a humility, and you have to have the eyes of the heart, right?
Yeah.
That comes when you've been kissed by love to see, to really see beyond just yourself and your species and your kind and your gender. It takes that kiss of love to open the eyes of the heart to really begin to see.
Because if sin is a power at work, then it exists simply because we have abdicated our trust in love. Because if God is love and he holds all things together, we've abdicated that. We are the ones causing the problems in the cosmos. To the animal kingdom, to the rainforests, to the stars. You know, I was reading a thing that very soon they will not be able to launch any more satellites into space because of all the debris that's up there. It's crazy. I mean, what kind of damage is that doing? You know, as much as I love my technology, what kind of damage is that doing to everything? You know? And so the only way to deal with that issue is to return to the place of love. It's about returning humanity to the guidance and the shelter of love, because that's the only way that things can be made right. And I think that's what John is speaking about in the Revelation, when he says, you know, that the heavens and the earth are being made new. It's not like they're going to be a different kind of heaven or a different kind of earth. It's like there's this renewal that God will bring about, and I believe it's through humanity returning to the leading of love, allowing love to show us how to live on this planet and take care of it, which was the original charge given to the man and woman, wasn't it? Take care of the air.
I think you're talking about the reciprocity of communion, right?
And yes.
Communion with one another, communion with the land, you know, all of that. There's a reciprocity in it. And Doug was just watching this documentary on Netflix. It's an indigenous documentary called Gather. I don't know if either of you have seen it. But in the documentary, one of the things that they were talking about was their reciprocal relationship with bison, with all of the buffalo, and how they use the buffalo, you know, for clothes, they used it for skin, they used it for, you know, of course for meat, but all these different things. But the buffalo actually is an animal that would heal itself. If the buffalo was sick, the buffalo went into the wild and would eat medicinal plants and herbs to heal whatever was going on with it. Wow. So of course then, when the indigenous people ate the buffalo, they would be also eating these healthy, you know, medicinal herbs and plants, from the field, and you could just see this circle of life, this reciprocal communion between animal and human inside of this. It was a beautiful telling, but they talked about how when their land was colonized, the first thing that these people did when they came in was they killed millions and millions and millions of the buffalo, because by killing the buffalo, they then starved the indigenous people who had to depend on them for, you know, welfare for their food. And so they would get these government packages for food. And when that happened, the indigenous people started getting diabetes and different health issues and all of that. Some from the food, but also because they lost this reciprocal communion that they had with the kingdom that was creating their own natural survival. And I wonder, again, when we recapture that, the sacredness, even John, you were talking about, you know, technology and how it can be bad. But I'm sitting there wondering, what is our reciprocal communion with technology? It would be like this. Like, here we are, three people that have this common thing of, you know, being in ministry together and have been touched by the same ministry. And we're in three different places across the globe. And yet the sacredness of technology brings us together for this time, right? And so I think part of that restorative justice is reclaiming reciprocal communion.
I love that, Felicia. Just as you're talking, I'm thinking, but the gospel we preach doesn't make room for reciprocity, because it's transactional. No, that... Oh, well, that's just getting really huge in my brain, and I can't really... it's like, but the reciprocity is the exact opposite of the gospel we preach. You know, we talk about the communion of the saints, but there is no communion.
Yeah.
It's all, like you say, it's hierarchical. It's full of conflict. It's full of selfish ambition and transaction. You know, well, I will do this for you on condition that you... And that's how we've put God, isn't it? We've put God in that. God is saying, I will do this for you, but only if you believe this, behave like this, go here, worship like this. You know, and unfortunately, churches do the same thing. You can belong to us, you can be a part of us, as long as you adhere to our rules, our way of thinking, our beliefs, our doctrine, theology, and everything else. It's all transactional. Wow. Oh, you've just blown my mind with that.
That's why we need more indigenous theologians.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. I don't know where to go with that now. Because it's true, isn't it? We always require something of people if they want to belong. You know, if you can't come to all the meetings, then go somewhere else. And you leave a congregation of believers and no one ever gets in touch with you. And you suddenly realize it was all a lie. There was no family. It was transactional. Because it's a transactional gospel we preach. God will forgive you if you do this and this and this and this. Wow.
And sadly, those of us who've grown up in families who function on the same level, when you then come into a community of faith that works on that, you start living like that. And then when you break out of it, you have the same experience. And you always feel like the black sheep. You always feel like the one that doesn't belong. And that's exactly the people Jesus came for, you know, to include them, to bring them in, you know. And I think that's where also, because there is this disconnect with the land and with creation and with each other, this interconnection that we experience it to a certain degree with the help of technology, is because that's so many people struggle with mental health issues, I think, these days, you know. And then you bring in all these doctrines about God's going to barbecue forever and you need to punish someone else and what else. You know, it's a recipe for disaster.
I mean, we started off with that quote from Brad, you know, about the inconsistency of love and these dogmatic systems of belief we have. And I think as we've talked, we've actually exposed a lot of that dichotomy when you try to hold on to both things, you know, the dissonant thinking that's necessary and the denial of... I think for me, seeing people encounter this revelation and coming up short because they don't like where love is going to take them. Because, one, God forgive me if I'm judging here, I don't mean to be, but if I go down that road, I lose ministry, I lose supporters, I lose money, I lose reputation, I lose prominence. And you know, forgive my language, but I've just come to a place I don't give a shit. I want to go where love leads me. And I know that there are lonely times in that journey. But along that journey, I always meet people who are walking the same road. There's always company. There's always a realization, I'm not alone in this. And there's a realization that actually reputation and ministry aren't important. Because you see, love doesn't actually need me to do its work for it. What it does is give me the privilege of joining it in its work. I'm piggybacking on someone else who's far bigger than me and far bigger than anything I could ever do or create.
Yeah.
And if it means I lose reputation and I lose income and I lose all of that stuff, then so be it. Those things are not important. Those things are not eternal. Love is forever. And as much as my humanity at times does struggle with ego and desire and everything else, love always brings me back to this is what matters. And the more I know of love, the more I realise love is not interested in violent wrath. It's not interested in retribution, or it's not self-interested. You know, I read those statements of Paul in 1 Corinthians 13 with whole new eyes now about what love is. And we've always taken it as some sort of recipe for how you should be as a Christian believer. But it's not. This is a description of who God is and how he treats us. And if it's true that love never gives up, then death is not the end for anyone. Because even after death, love will never give up, because love exists outside of time and space. And so no matter where you go when you're dead, the grave or where your spirit goes or whatever, I don't have a clue what happens. Love is still there. Love is in that place. That is mind-blowing. And when faced with the vastness of that, my selfish desire for ministry and reputation and everything else is so petty and tawdry that I'm ashamed of it in my more lucid moments.
Because we all came into this through ministry, right? I mean,
yeah, of course.
We've all been itinerant ministers, you know, sharing this revelation of Father's love. There's something that calls to you inside of it that you want to give it away.
Yeah.
And I think what happens is, I remember in 2016 deciding that I was actually with the team. We were doing an A school, and I had taught a session, and I'd said some things that were
out there.
Let's just say that. And so the next session, one of the team leaders kind of cleaned it up for me very nicely behind, not for me, because I firmly believe in what I've said, you know, but to put it back within the bounds of what the guidelines were accepted. And so after another trip that fall with the ministry team, I was like, I think I need to sit all this down. I need to figure out why. Why am I? Because I wanted to be a team leader. I wanted to be able to, you know, lead schools. I had that ambition. I wanted that. I mean, for a good cause, I thought, but it's something that I wanted. And Duff didn't necessarily have the same fervor about it that I did. And because I was married, I needed him to be on board in order for us to both be team leaders, right? And so he always supported me in what I wanted with that, but it wasn't necessarily his passion. It wasn't what drove him, you know? And so I was like, okay, this is a good time to, let's sit this down. And literally for 2 years, I stopped taking invites to be on teams. I stopped taking invites to preach. I stopped, you know, it has to be something bigger than my ambition and wanting to be a team leader and wanting to, and what is that? Mm-hmm. And that what compels me is love. What compels me is the freedom that love gives. And what I realized is for some, love is very attractive and they will do everything to seek out that, you know, relationship with divine love. And for some, it's scary as hell. Like, they taste it and they're like, no, the cost of this is too big. I'm not ready to pay that cost. And I think love is always inviting us to go beyond the borders, right? To go beyond. But love also, like, is very patient with us. It's never going to force us to go where we're not ready. But if you're ready to take the journey to live and move and have your being in love, love will dance with you in this thing, you know, and it will cost you. You will be misunderstood. You will be challenged because it will rub some people the wrong way. Oh, yes. And
it rubs me up the wrong way and I want it.
Hello, you know, but after I was able to sit down the ambition and say, This is what I know to be true. I know that each person on earth, really each matter, there's a gift. We have a gift inside of us, right? And when we say yes to that gift and we offer it to love, it becomes an offering to the world around us. And so I could keep saying no to every invitation and misparticipating with love and in the gift that love plays within me. Or I could just say, I don't have to do this from a motive of ambition or wanting to be a leader or wanting to, you know, create a platform or a name, and just say, if the door opens, I'll say yes. Unless there's a strong no, if it's an opportunity to share what you place within me, I'll say yes to that. And I will pour this out as an offering and let it be just that. And whoever receives from it can take the fragrance of it. And if they don't, they don't. And I'm okay with that too. You know, and I think that changes then to release us to be able to do exactly what you're doing, John, to take this gift that you have within you and your writing and your podcasting and your speaking and sharing and offer it. But it doesn't come from an ego trip.
Not anymore. Not all the time.
I guess. We can all still be a little orphan hearted every now and then. So,
ambition has been curtailed rather than completely taken away. I don't think it ever completely gets taken away in this side of eternity, whatever eternity looks like. So, I'm me. I've learned to live with being me. Because love seems to be comfortable with me being me. And I never hear love saying, John, you better do this or else, you know, or there's none of that. When I hear that, that's just my gran's voice. You know, that's just my grandma's voice saying, John, you better do that or else.
And that's the thing, is that we've grown up expecting certain things, how God, love, yep, acts towards us, and a lot of people, they can't receive it because or we very often can't receive it because we expect that's what he would do, and he just doesn't. A lot of the things how I thought God sees me and acts towards me, he never did. You know, when and it makes it really hard for people to receive. So a lot of people go to counseling and they expect to be hear from God, you need to sort this out and, you know, lay down the straight and narrow, and he just doesn't. Yeah. But then we humans jump in and we put burdens on people or put burdens on ourselves. And I think that's what it comes down to with these things we talk about, these doctrines and dogmas we talked about. It's almost like we put something in place, like don't take it too far, you know. Don't trust too much, don't lean too much into it. You know, there's still something lurking behind the back of love.
I do. I think at the end of the day, what the message of love is that people matter, right? And I think so much of it is that we get trapped in things that have been perverted and things that have been profaned. And love is about restoration. And restorative justice is just that, right? It's bringing back into alignment the truth of our being, that we are sacred. And restoring the sacred in all. And I feel like, honestly, when I look at the life of Jesus, as far as how I read it anyway, I see him really restoring the sacred in his relationships with people and the messages that he gave. It was all about that, the restoration of the sacred, you know? And so when we recapture that in each other, when we recapture that in our environment and our dealings with, you know, the animal and the plant kingdom as well, I think that is the thing that creation is waiting for, is for us to remember that sacredness, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. And if love has created that sacredness, then why would it destroy it through violence and wrath and retribution and eternal torment? It's a complete contradiction of love's nature, isn't it? And so I think for those of us who have come into this experience of love through the Father's Heart revelation, we're beginning to see those contradictions and abandon them. And I think that's where a lot of those who are deconstructing have missed the mark. They're doing it outside of the parameters of love.
Yeah.
But when you're inside love, actually, I think love takes you further than deconstruction does, because you go beyond that breakdown into a whole new world. It's like, you know, the last battle, C.S. Lewis in the Narnia Chronicles, when it's like further up and further in, and the further up and further in you go, the more beautiful it becomes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I love that idea, Felicia, of the sacredness of everything. That's beautiful. That's a beautiful picture. Wow. Well, I think I know what the three of us are like. We could probably talk about loads of stuff for ages, but we'll do this again sometime. But it's been great having you guys. I love chatting with you. I love the conversation. I love the stuff that you make me think and ask questions, and you blow my mind with small statements that you make, and it's just wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.